Across the Pacifica network and over 50 community stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 21st, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez. In a shock move, Saddam Hussein releases all the country's prison inmates. As the judicial system drags its feet, communities rally for the freedom of five black men jailed in the Central Park jogger case in New York City. And progressive Congresswoman Patsy Mink's death late last month has left a hole for her constituents. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Anti-war protesters took their message inside the United Nations today as the U.S. circulated a new resolution against Iraq. Susan Wood reports from the UN.
Posing as tourists, members of the group No Blood for Oil entered the UN General Assembly Hall today and began chanting "No War in Iraq" before being expelled by security guards. No meeting was taking place at the time. The group demanded the immediate lifting of UN sanctions against Iraq and called on the UN not to allow an invasion of the country at any time. Six of the 13 demonstrators were later arrested by New York police. Others were arrested while sitting in outside the U.S. mission to the UN, where the five permanent members of the Security Council were meeting to consider a draft resolution the U.S. hopes to formally introduce this week. The resolution drops explicit threats of force against Iraq, but warns of serious consequences if Baghdad obstructs weapons inspections. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
The United States and Indian Air Forces engaged in joint military exercises today in Agra near Delhi. Vinod K. Jose reports from New Delhi.
According to experts, this exercise is significant because it is the biggest in terms of both number of personnel and equipment that the two countries have ever performed until now. Officials stated that the aim of the exercise is to prepare the two forces to undertake joint operations if the need arises in the days to come. The recent fresh air in the Indo-US relationship is said to be because of India's strategic position in the disturbed region and its widely opened big market. And the increasing cooperation in military affairs between the two countries shows that both countries want to expand their cooperation beyond just economic and political dimensions. From New Delhi, in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
The tightest presidential election in Ecuador's recent history ended yesterday with the two top candidates in a near tie. Now banana tycoon Alvaro Noboa and young Colonel Lucio Gutierrez move into a runoff to highlight their starkly different positions on the economy. Noboa is Ecuador's richest man and part owner of a $1 billion banana empire. He is also accused of authorizing hooded thugs to stop unionization of his plant. Gutierrez, as a colonel in the army, helped lead a nonviolent coup in 2000 that ousted the last elected president with assistance from unions, indigenous people, and junior army officers. The runoff election is scheduled for November 24th. Thatcher Collins provided that report from Quito. Today, the narrowly divided United States Supreme Court declined considering an end to the execution of juveniles convicted of murder. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
Four of the nine justices wanted to re-examine the execution of minors, which critics believe violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Dissenting justices said that the execution of minors is also inconsistent with the evolving standards of decency in a civilized society. The court also declined to examine whether it is cruel and unusual punishment to leave inmates on death row for decades before executing them. Justice Clarence Thomas said that the inmate, Charles Foster, could have escaped his 27 years on death row by simply submitting to what the people of Florida have deemed him to deserve, execution. At the Supreme Court, I'm Ellen Ratner for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the word organic takes a formal U.S. government definition as the U.S. Department of Agriculture establishes national guidelines. Vanessa Tate reports.
The new standards will allow the organic label only on products that are made from at least 95% organic ingredients. Organic food activists fought to shape the regulations for more than a decade. The height of the debate came in 1998. Ronnie Cummins, National Director of the Organic Consumers Association.
It's a victory for consumers, these USDA standards. You know, they are just minimum standards, and there's a lot of concern on the part of the organic community that the Bush administration is going to try to lower these standards. So we're going to remain vigilant, and actually our coalition began taking legal action against the USDA last week.
That lawsuit accuses the USDA of breaking the new law by not setting up a peer-reviewed body to oversee its organic operations. Organic foods now account for about 3% of all foods sold, or $9 billion a year, a number that has been doubling every 4 years. In Berkeley, I'm Vanessa Tate for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraq remains stunned today, less than 24 hours after Saddam Hussein announced that he was emptying all of the country's prisons, releasing even political prisoners, army deserters, and those convicted of crimes against the state. The Iraqi government said the move was a gesture of gratitude from the president after he claimed a 100% yes vote in last week's national referendum. Celebrations continued through the night in the streets and cities of Iraq. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Jeremy Scahill files this report from Abu Ghraib prison outside of Baghdad.
It all began earlier in the day as word began to spread that the Iraqi president was going to address the nation with what many people said they had heard would be good news. Shortly after noon, regular programming on all of Iraq's television stations was interrupted by an announcement from Iraq's Information Minister Mohammed Sahaf. He read a decree from the Iraqi president.
A complete, comprehensive, and final amnesty for all jailed prisoners, fugitives, and military deserters, in addition to the jailed prisoners, those detained for political reasons, and all other reasons, including those sentenced to death, will be set free immediately.
The government said that those people accused of spying for Israel or the United States would remain in prison. As word spread about the announcement, caravans of cars hit the highway out of Baghdad, honking their horns and speeding toward Abu Ghraib, 20 miles west of the capital city. Outside the prison, many people abandoned their cars in the middle of the highway and joined in the celebration. It took barely an hour for the crowd outside the prison to swell so large that the guards could no longer contain the people. Eventually, the masses burst through the main gate. Once inside, people scattered everywhere throughout the compound.
We have now made it onto the grounds of the Abu Ghraib prison, where foreign cameras have never been before. Thousands of people have just burst through the gates. They are trying to find their loved ones who have been imprisoned here in the Abu Ghraib prison.
As the mayhem continued, a camouflage Iraqi army helicopter hovered overhead. Rumor spread that Saddam was actually on board. Not likely. But moments later, prisoners began emerging from their cells, many with looks of pure disbelief on their faces. None of them had been told what was happening. They were simply informed that they were free men.
It's a happy, new, bright new day. I want to say thanks for our president leader, Saddam Hussein, for his offers and presenting a new life for a new people and opening a new page of the life in the future. I'm very, very happy because I'm going home to my people, to my family, to my friends, to my beautiful wife and babies.
Though many of these men were convicted of political crimes or crimes against the state, they chanted that they would give their blood for Saddam in the fight against America. Then came the moment of ultimate jubilation. Mothers finding their sons. brothers reuniting. One young man had to be restrained by his family after learning that his mother had died while he was in prison.
This is a day that has shocked Iraq and stunned the world. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein emptying the country's prisons, even releasing political prisoners. This at a time when George W. Bush is threatening to attack Iraq.
One of the most shocking events of the day, and this is saying a lot, did not happen at Abu Ghraib. It happened in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, in an interview on ABC's This Week, said the amnesty was a political ploy by Saddam, saying it was, quote, typical of this man's use of human beings for these political purposes of his. It almost sounded like Powell preferred that the men remain in prison.
Finish.
But at the end of the day, no one at Abu Ghraib seemed concerned with any political purposes. The evidence of that could be clearly seen in the half-eaten lunches and abandoned possessions in the prison dorms. The celebrations continue through the night here in a jubilant, shocked country. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill at Abu Ghraib Prison outside of Baghdad.
For more reports from Iraq, go to www.iraqjournal.org. A New York City judge is giving prosecutors more time to complete their report on whether the convictions of men in the Central Park jogger case should be overturned. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office explained that his office had to review some 15,000 pages of court transcripts and interview numerous people. Meanwhile, the parents of the five men say that given the DNA evidence and the confession of a man who said he acted alone, their sons' names should be cleared. Supporters of the young men staged a rally outside the courthouse today calling for their exoneration of rape charges. Dred Scott Keyes files this report from New York City.
It was Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau who threw the full weight of his office in the quest to convict the five men, who were then teenagers, of raping a Solomon Brothers investment banker on April 19, 1989. Kerry Wise, Antron McCray, Kevin Richardson, Yusuf Salam, and Raymond Santana served from 7 to 12 years for a crime which they say they did not commit, even though prosecutors have so-called confessions. The trials were racially charged as the city was whipped into a frenzy by the media and well-known city figures like Realtor Donald Trump, who called for the death penalty for the black and Latino youth. However, in January of this year, a convicted rapist named Mateus Reyes told officials that he alone attacked the jogger. Reyes is currently serving a life sentence for murder and rape. Authorities confirmed that Reyes's DNA was the only DNA found in the jogger's body aside from her boyfriend's. Since his admission, controversy has again gripped the case, with senior prosecutors reportedly at odds on how to proceed, and civil rights activists, politicians, the parents, and the clergy demanding that the men be cleared. Today's decision to delay has infuriated supporters of the young men. Speaking outside the courthouse, attorney Michael Tarif Warren says there's no reason for the delay in exonerating them.
The legal standard is whether, in fact, the evidence that now exists is material, and for those reasons, it is material, and whether, if it had existed at the time of the offense, at the time of the trial, whether it would have, in all probabilities, caused the jury to vote a different way. In fact, it would have. And that's the only thing that the judge should have decided today. The fact that he did not and gave them extra time is unwarranted.
Roger Wareham, another lawyer working on the case, called the boys' confessions into question.
First of all, they weren't confessions, they were statements. Those boys, those children, did not make confessions. They gave statements that had been elicited from the police department, who told them, look, in order for you to go home, you got to tell us something. And didn't you see this? And didn't you see that? And, you know, you're going to go home, but just we got to have something. And that was how those statements were elicited. And the statements were, implicating other people, but not themselves. And when you put them all together, everybody implicates everybody else, and that's how you put together like a jigsaw puzzle. And that's how they do that.
Viola Plummer of the December 12th movement says the lack of support for the mothers, even by progressive white women's groups, and the subsequent railroading of the defendants can be explained in one word: racism.
Because they accepted lock, stock, and barrel the non-evidence that white men organized and came up with. There was not any probing of these men. There was no real inquiry. Here is these known white men in the police department who has a history of dealing with young black boys.
The judges set a date of December 5th for another hearing on the case and whether the young men should be exonerated. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
This year marks the 30th anniversary of the Title IX legislation, which mandates equal access for women in education. The founding force behind the bill was Hawaii's late Congresswoman, Patsy Tecumoto Mink. Recently, Congress recognized Mink's resolve and honored her memory by renaming Title IX as the Patsy T. Mink Equal Opportunity in Education Act. Mink has created a potent legacy of political activism and social responsibility. However, her death has left her constituents without a congressional voice. From community radio station KKCR on the island of Kauai, Donna Lewis-Jarman has this report.
Last month closed with the unexpected death of Democratic Congresswoman Patsy Tecumoto Mink. Just a few months earlier, the enthusiastic Congresswoman was a featured speaker at a Kauai forum on the status of women in politics. Mink reflected on her formative years in the bustling sugarcane plantation town of Paea, Maui.
I grew up with the feeling that America meant everything to even the lowliest, most humble person living in a plantation. And so when I thought about what I wanted to be, I decided I wanted to be a medical doctor.
Mink attended the University of Hawaii, majoring in pre-med studies. After graduation, she applied to a dozen medical schools, but was rejected by each one because of her gender.
It was a shock. My belief and all the things that I cared about were torn.
Deeply disillusioned by the biased medical school community, Mink shifted her focus. In 1956, she began her political career as a member of the Territory of Hawaii's House of Representatives, 3 years before statehood. After serving 8 years in state politics, Mink became the first Asian American woman to be elected to national office.
I had the opportunity to go to Congress. The very first thing I said was, education has to be an equal opportunity promise to every single person in America, regardless of their race and regardless of their sex.
At Mink's memorial service in Honolulu earlier this month, thousands gathered to pay tribute to the Honorable Patsy Tecumoto Mink. State Representative Mina Morita attended the ceremony.
I think the amazing thing about her memorial service was the diverse people that came to pay their respects. And it showed not only her impact that she had on a national level, but how she never forgot that these were the people she represented.
Many in Hawaii feel Mink's voice continues to reverberate. Known as a tireless advocate for equality and justice, the next generation of women political leaders say Mink was their inspiration. Hawaii State Representative Mina Morita.
As a woman entering politics, we couldn't have had a better role model than Patsy Mink. You know, what she represented was deep conviction in serving the people that were not usually heard in the political arena, and that was women, children, and the poor. Anything morally wrong will never be politically correct, and she exemplified that.
Former Kauai mayor and county council candidate Joanne Yukimura has also been influenced by Mink.
Well, she was definitely an inspiration to me because she was an Asian woman who was out there fighting for social justice and for civil rights. And for me, there was no limits to what I could do because I could see her doing it.
Mink's death has created a void in the political continuum. Her seat remains unfilled, and her constituents remain unrepresented. Sadly, the death of a determined advocate for equal opportunity has left her constituents without a congressional voice. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Donna Lewis-Jarman on Kauai.
An annual call to open the U.S.-Mexico border is growing in popularity. For the second year in a row, marchers have mobilized to show their opposition to border enforcement policies and the proposed Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. As Joe Gardner-Wesley reports from El Paso, Texas, an increasing number of marchers from the Gulf Coast of Mexico to the Pacific Coast are blocking the border in order to open it.
Estamos en contra, pero de las políticas de nuestros presidentes, tanto Bush.
Over the weekend, several hundred protesters took to the bridges between Ciudad Juarez and El Paso for a little over an hour. They blocked car traffic to give speeches and release doves and balloons to commemorate the hundreds of young women in Juarez who have disappeared or been murdered.
As many of you know, as we're on this bridge today, they're also in Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Mexico. Also, we just received communications from Matamoros and Brownsville that hundreds and hundreds of sisters and brothers are having a demonstration in action there at the crossing.
Richard Moore of the Southwest Network for Environmental and Economic Justice was one of several speakers at the bi-national United Without Borders rally.
It was not our choice to close this bridge.
No fue nuestra decisión cerrar este puente.
But when they do not leave and leave this bridge open, then we must do what's necessary.
Pero cuando no permanece este puente abierto, tenemos que hacer lo que es necesario.
Demonstrators came from Albuquerque in the north, while others converged from points south of Ciudad Juarez, Matamoros, and Nogales. Organizers also say campesino groups would hold actions in 60 strategic points around the state of Chihuahua. Many more also went to the San Diego-Tijuana crossing on the west coast. Last year, the United Without Borders protest took place in half as many sites and saw fewer participants. Richard Moore summarized protest demands at the Center for Border Area Agricultural Workers in El Paso.
We call for an open border based on trust, solidarity and friendship. And secondly, we're calling for an open border that eliminates racist practices. And thirdly, we call for an open border that allows for free movement of people, not just goods and capital.
Additionally, protest organizers called for the removal of border enforcement policies like Operations Gatekeeper, Hold the Line, Rio Grande, and Safeguard. Enforcement policies, they say, have failed. That's El Paso musical group Fuga, who accompanied marchers on their way to block the bridge to Juarez. Organizers plan to hold events in 6 border cities next year, 2 more than this year. Alma Makitiko of the Border Network for Human Rights says demonstrations like these will not stop until the people of this land gain the rights and respect they deserve.
Necesitamos una nueva legalización. Y necesitamos una nueva amnistía ahora.
We need a new legalization. We need a new amnesty now. An amnesty that legally recognizes the rights of workers. Not just a bracero program where they come and bring people here without paying what they should. If we're going to come and work in this country, we need to be paid well. We need our rights protected. They can't abuse us anymore. They need to give us the right to legalize ourselves in this country.
A legalizarnos en este país.
Last week, House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt introduced a bill that would grant undocumented immigrants legal status under certain conditions, but Gephardt has also stated that it has little chance of passing this year. Veronica Carmona of the Center for Border Area Agricultural Workers mistrusts this proposal.
Those are the proposals of politicians who are only looking at the election season and saying, now I'm going to ask for a new amnesty. Now I'm going to ask if they'll give permits to the workers who are already here. We don't believe in false promises anymore. What we're telling our people is that they stop believing in those politicians' promises because they mislead us.
Last week, United Without Borders organizers delivered a letter to President Vicente Fox at Mexican consulates in 17 U.S. cities and to President Bush. The letter calls for, quote, a total end to the repression that's taking place along the U.S.-Mexico border and an end to the military closure of the border. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joe Gardner-Wesley in Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua.
Psychiatrists who conducted a study in the riot-hit western Indian state of Gujarat concluded that they found post-traumatic stress disorders, or PTSD, high among women. More than 37% had PTSD, which they believe could lead to a high rate of suicidal tendency. Unlike in past riots, the women and children were the main target of the mob that avenged the killings of some Hindu activists. More than 1,000 perished in the early March violence. Binu Alex reports from Ahmedabad.
Since early March this year, when the worst ever sectarian violence between Hindus and Muslims broke, every night, many of these women survivors stay awake, and many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. One of them, Mariam Bibi, witnessed the brutal killing of her 20-year-old handicapped son. She says the trauma is too hard for her to forget so easily.
We have seen it with our eyes. We are scared, really scared, and lifelong we have to face this.
The government promised rehabilitation, but many of the survivors are left without housing, food, water, money, family, work, and essentially safety. 7 months after the violence erupted, the government still hasn't charged anyone in connection with the riots. Without the support of the government, a non-governmental organization commissioned a study on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Dr. Ganpat Vankar, the head of psychiatry in the government civil hospital, survived many of the riot-hit places in Ahmedabad. He says the problem is much larger than what it is seen.
For the riots-affected women, say it was one of the major stresses of their life. Currently, many of the families are without livelihood, without place to live in, and all this would lead to tremendous stress in time to come. And the wounds can heal only if there are very strong rehabilitative measures coupled with, say, very good psychosocial interventions.
The study found many women have experienced so much violence that they are filled with anger and hate. These women have few interests now and show few emotions towards their brothers and sisters. Many say they have given up the hope of living. 7 months after the riot, the stress continues longer than the doctors anticipated. The riots were triggered after some 58 Hindu activists were burned to death inside a train compartment. Immediately after, the local Gujarat dailies reported about Hindu women dragged, raped and killed from the same compartment. Women activists who closely monitored the carnage against Muslims that followed attribute the high rate of PTSD among women to the high level of violence against women and children. Dr. Khyati Mehta, a medical student who helped with the study, says the disorder could multiply further if no care is taken. She says psychiatrists believe women stand to be more vulnerable to PTSD than men.
Checklist included the manifestations mainly under three groups, that is, re-experiencing of the traumatic event, avoidance of the stimuli that reminded the person of the event, and hyperarousal symptoms. We found that among the total 300 women screened, 113, that is 37.6%, had PTSD. We also correlated some of the risk factors like death of a family member, injury to a family member, assault on family member, injury to self, assault on self, damage to home, damage to property, separation from family members, and watching mutilated dead bodies. And we found that factors like injury to self and separation from family members had a high correlation with the development of PTSD.
The study also indicates that the hyperarousal and subthreshold PTSD may lead to suicides. Dr. Mehta makes her point as she translates one of the poems written by an aggrieved poet about the city.
Your city is like a burning courtyard. Your city is like a broken bangle. I do not intend to come to your city. I do not wish to come to your city.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Binu Alex in Ahmedabad, India.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.